Okay, Dan. Thanks very much. Is this working? Right. Great. I don't want to spend too much time introducing myself, but let me say that I got my PhD at U of T, and I really appreciate how nice it is to come here in February and have weather like this. I was prepared for the worst. As you can, let me just explain the title of this presentation. For those of you who work in finance, you know that people, there are two types of people as I see it. You have some who are very highly specialized, you know, the traders, the some of the salesmen, they know particular products extremely well. And then you have people who are, I would describe as generalists, for example, the risk management people who know lots and lots of products, but they really don't have an in-depth understanding of any particular one, with few exceptions. And you very seldom see people who try to sort of cover a lot of similar products and understand how they relate to each other and look for some consistency. I hope you agree with my statement. And my personal interest is fixed income analytics. And we get involved with bonds, with interest rate derivatives, with mortgage-backed securities, all kinds of bonds. And I'm shocked, just to tell you what happened a few weeks ago, in the U.S. a new type of bond was introduced called Build America Bonds. Some of you may have heard of it. These are bonds issued by municipalities, but they are not tax exempt. Now, in Canada, there is no tax exempt market. In the U.S., there's $3 trillion tax exempt bonds. Suddenly, the people who, in the old days, or traditionally, have been working with tax-exempt bonds, suddenly they have to become familiar and start talking about taxable bonds. Well, quantitatively, a bond is a bond. What's the big deal? You would be shocked to see the confusion, the misunderstandings, the lack of appreciation of what the taxable people know about the tax-exempt people, and vice versa. And the situation here is going to be somewhat different. Here we have mortgage backs and bonds, and so that's kind of the theme. I'm going to, just a word of warning, I will start kind of on a high level and talk in fixed income, risk management in general, and then that's about the first third or so of the presentation, and then I start talking about mortgage backs specifically. So that's what I would like to do. But let me just start with some quotes about mortgage-backed securities. Now, I pulled up some at random. The first one is from Ben Golub. Some of you probably know Ben at BlackRock. And he said, he talks about the actual sensitivity of MSR stands for mortgage servicing rights, whatever they are. They're like IOs, interest only strips, some derivative of mortgages. He said the actual sensitivity to implied volatility is complex and controversial, says, this is a quote. But was kind of, here's another quote that I heard from a fellow who is an advisor on asset liability management, and he said something like, I was at the presentation, and he said, our model, when we try to volatility hedge mortgage servicing rights, it doesn't even give us the right sign. And as I was thinking about it, and I became very interested in this, why not? It was about 2 years ago and actually published a paper, and I realized what was the problem, and I'll share it with you. And then just a couple of weeks ago, I was talking to a very large hedge fund in New York, and a person who's a real pro in mortgage backs just said casually, he said, you know, the price response when we put in a skew adjustment it just doesn't seem right. I wonder why. And I try to explain to you at least why I think what has gone wrong. So let me now just talk about fixed income analytics in general. I'll do this very quickly. I assume most of you work in fixed income, I assume, or in risk management. So I do, just for the sake of completeness, I would like to cover some of these points. So we do two things. One is valuation, pricing. Get the fair value given the environment, and the environment, what's the environment? We have some benchmark yield curve, some volatility, and so on. And then for risk management, it's kind of a variation on this. We start with a price normally and say, what if? What happens if we change the environment? What's going to be the price response? And that's going to be my focus in this presentation. So it's not so much how do I get the fair value. I assume the value is given. What happens to that value when I shock the system? And again, on a very, very high level, how do we value fixed income securities? What makes fixed income sort of more interesting than one of the most interesting parts of finance, as far as I'm concerned, is that there's a yield curve. And that whole yield curve moves somehow. And so, on a high level, you generate some yield curves using some process, and I'm not going to be specific. Whatever process you use is fine. And then, given some security that you're interested in valuing, you follow what happens to that security, assuming the yield curve moves in a certain way. Now, the focus of my talk is going to be on option exercise, because securities can be callable, they can be puttable, there could be other options. And so what happens? And how does that option get exercised? And then once you know the cash flows, you can discount and average and get some value. But that's a basic process. I'm kind of just don't want to belabor this point. However, I do want to tell you, turning to risk management, what are the steps, the standard steps in risk management, given a price? So the price is the starting point, and typically the first step in the analysis is, given the current parameters, we compute the option-adjusted spread, just as a spread that encompasses credit risk, liquidity risk, whatever. And when we do risk analysis, we assume that spread is constant, and then we start shocking the system by looking at different yield curves, different volatilities. And that's what I'm going to do. So that's what happens. We compute an OES, we fix the OES, and then we shock the system and do the what ifs. We're going to determine these data pieces. Now, let me say a few words about bonds and swaps and cancelable swaps, interest rate derivatives. The key observation I would like to make, that the option exercise rules are standard. There's no controversy when you talk about the callable bonds. At least in theory, you can say, when should the option be exercised? And in plain English, the option should be exercised when it's worth more dead than alive. That's what it is. You have to compute it somehow, and you have to, if you want to be more precise about it, you have to look at transaction costs, you have to look at taxes, whatever. But essentially, you compute the option value, you compute what you get for it, and if you get more for it, or you get as much for it as it's worth, you have to exercise it. If there is time value, you leave it outstanding. And I will be focusing on option value. So keep in mind, I just want to remind you, the greater the option value, the more you're willing to wait, the more time value there is. Everything else being the same. And the key is that since the exercise rules are the same, different systems, if they are implemented more or less correctly, should give you the same answer. So even if you don't know what's going on, a good system will kind of protect you. Any decent system should protect you. And I'm going to show that momentarily. But this is not the case with mortgage-backed securities, and that's why we have these comments about things not quite making, people are feeling uneasy about results. Because you have different prepayment rules for different systems, and I'm going to spend some time towards the end of my talk about explaining what these prepayment rules look like and what the problem is. So when you have different prepayment rules, you have different cash flows and so on. So how can you tell, the question is, how can you tell if a system is any good? Now, so here's what I'm going to do. today, first I will talk about what happens when you have standardized accepted analytics. We're going to have a quiz, actually. I haven't told you that, but it's coming up momentarily. And that's for bonds. And the key observation I would like to make, and here's the connection between bonds and mortgage-backed securities or mortgages. A mortgage is just like a bond. It's a mini bond. So that's where you would like to have some consistency between exercise rules of bonds and mortgage-backed securities. And then we can talk about mortgage backs, which are just pools of mortgages. Okay. So here's the first question. Now, this is not a hard one. Suppose you have a callable bond, and the market risk, the yield curve rises. What happens to the expected life? And the expected life is like duration, basically, effective duration. So what happens? Does it get longer? Does it get shorter? It's an easy question. Not a trick question. Anybody? And I'm going to ask some hard questions, but this is easy. What happens? It increases. Sure. Absolutely. Because the bond is less likely to be called. That's it, right? Very simple. So far, so good. But now, here comes the second question. It's still about bonds, simple callable bonds, nothing good, magic, okay, nothing complicated. What happens to a callable bond when volatility increases? What happens to the expected life? Now, this is a harder question, and I wonder how many of you actually know the answer. It doesn't stock, the interest rate volatility. When I say volatility, I mean the yield curve volatility, and as depicted by the short-term rate in the black currency, whatever. Just interest rates become more volatile. But the yield curve is the same. So what happens to the expected life or duration of a callable bond when I leave the yield curve, the base yield curve, the same, but I assume it's more going to be more volatile going forward? And this is kind of critical to what I'm going to discuss. Anybody wants to take a guess? You think it goes up? You think it goes up? The call price goes up, yeah, but what happens to the expected life? That's right. That's a very good point. The option value increases, and that's critical, and that's one of the observations that we have to keep in mind. Absolutely, and that's going to be critical. But I'll tell you, it's kind of interesting, unless you want to know. Here it is. It depends on the coupon of the bond, because if you have low coupon bonds, which are way out of the money, if you have a higher volatility, they are more likely to be rates are more likely to go down, and now you can shorten the expected life. Otherwise, the option would not be exercised. But if you look at bonds that are kind of in the money or close to it, it gets to the observation that you made. Suddenly, the option value is worth more, so the expected life is going to be longer. The duration lengthens, doesn't shorten. Very important point. And that is not intuitive at all until you start thinking about it. But when you do, it's pretty obvious. Okay? This is very, very important. And you see, I don't believe that, you may say, but here's an exhibit. You can probably see. So here the interest rates are 6% flat. And I have different coupons. You can see it. And here's the low coupon, high coupon. So when I have a 5% volatility, you can see the expected life is long. You can see on the low coupon bonds, the expected life is very high. But if I go to a 15% volatility, which is the red line, the expected life comes down, as we discussed. But on this end, when the coupon is higher, the expected life gets longer when I increase the volatility, because the option is worth more, so you are less willing to give it up. I hope you're following me, right? And you can write a program like that. Write program, just do the calculation and convince yourself. You don't have to take my word for it. But what's interesting, I actually conducted a survey a few months ago, and I sent it to several friends, acquaintances, and I said, hey, what do you think about this question? What happens? Same question that I just asked you. What's going to be the answer? And these are fixed income pros. And you can see the results. 40% said lengthens, 40%. You cannot see it. that shortens 20% of, I don't know. So they, even the pros are confused about this. So what would you expect the average risk manager to know about this? That's why you need good technology, so it should protect you. But luckily, good systems give you the same answer. So here is a bond. This is the Fannie Mae 570s at a certain price. And we said, all right, current volatility is about 30%. Let's shock the system. Well, it doesn't matter. What happens to the price at different bonds? And so we had our system, Bloomberg, third party, they all give you the same number. So you may not believe what happens, but luckily every decent system is going to give you the same number for callable bonds. All right? When you change volatility. Now, I'm now going to shift to mortgage-backed securities. And for those of you who are not familiar with these, I'm talking about mortgage backs, not in Canada, but in the U.S. And they are complicated because they are created out of essentially pools of mortgages, 15 or 30-year mortgages. And what makes mortgages so complicated in the U.S. is that they can refinance at any time. They can prepay at any time without penalty. There are other problems, too, because I'm not going to get into the subprimes. I'm talking about prime fixed coupon mortgages. Default is really not a big deal here, because even if they default, the investor receives the full principal. Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac will pay the principal. So these are just pools of mortgages for our purposes. And so I'm going to, at least I say, dominant risk is refinancing. And I'll be focusing on this option. That's the theme of this talk. What happens to this refinancing option and how does it affect the value of a mortgage-backed security? So how should we approach it? I'm going to tell you how we approached it, and I'm not saying this is the only way, but it should be a bottom-up approach, in my opinion. Understand individual mortgages, how a mortgagor, how a borrower refinances, how do you look at the refinancing decision, and then work from that up, bottom-up, to get the picture for the whole pool. That's what I'm going to do. That's not what is normally done, by the way, but that's how we're doing it. So now we get into this question of prepayment modeling. And you need prepayment modeling to value MBS. So one observation I just like to make is it's modeling the prepayment is only a means to an end. The point is not to describe what kind of cash flows you get under different scenarios. The point is to describe what happens to the value of the security as interest rates change. And so the focus is going to be on refinancing dynamics. And again, I've already told you, a mortgage, and a U.S. mortgage is the same as a Canadian mortgage, except in Canada the mortgage is a 25-year amortization and a 5-year balloon. In the U.S. it's a 30-year amortization and there's no balloon, but mathematically it's the same structure. And it's a callable amortizing bond. In Canada, there are severe prepayment penalties prior to year three, I guess, and so on. In the U.S., you can repay at any time, no penalty. And what we would like to have is, you would like to have some consistency between mortgages, how they prepay, and bonds, how they refinance, how they refund, when bonds are refunded. And the tool that we use is the measure to determine when to refinance and when not to refinance is the efficiency, which is simply you look at how much you save versus how much optionality you give up. And Stan, we're talking about operations research, and this is the work that we did back in 1974 at Bell Labs. That was, but it's kind of used routinely, and you can see how much you give up. And the idea is that don't give up the option, unless you capture a very high percentage, preferably 100% of the value. So if you know what you're doing, you should call a bond when efficiency reaches 100%, or you should refinance a mortgage when the efficiency of refinancing is 100%. By the way, it's a complicated decision, because often when you refinance, I just want to mention, you give up an option, you give up an old option, but you get a new option. So you're trading options, and you have to look at differences between option values, but let's not get into it. So let me just mention some rule of thumb. When should you refinance a mortgage? I'm talking about this U.S. mortgage. 20 years ago, people said, oh, you know, you need 200 basis points, 2% savings to do it. Today, you talk to rule of thumb, you talk about 50 to 70 basis points you should refinance. Why? The transaction costs have come down. It has become much easier. I'm just quoting this. Yes. Now, I became very interested in this whole topic when I first started thinking about mortgage-backed securities about 5-6 years ago. Interestingly, I had taken it for granted that the question of optimum refinancing must have been solved ages ago, because so many people refinance in the U.S. I was listening this morning to some mortgage brokers being interviewed. This was on NPR. And they were talking about how they were making 2 years ago once at $800,000 a year in annually. This is that people are not particularly well educated. They are mortgage brokers. And that wasn't. So there's a big money in it. And you would think, well, you could use some technology, some science to determine what's the optimum time to refinance. Well, it turns out there's no literature on that whatsoever. The literature that you see is in the realm of economics. Then people say, oh, people wait too long or whatever. But these are economists who never really tell you what's optimal. They always say everything is suboptimal, but nobody ever, I haven't been able to find a single paper anywhere, and there are hundreds of papers in the literature, mostly in economics, on mortgages. There is not one that tells you what's optimal. And I hope somebody will prove me wrong. So I became interested in it, and I realized that this standard bond technology can be applied in a very direct way to mortgages, residential mortgages. And I wrote some papers, and the Mortgage Bankers Association, which is a trade association that represents all the mortgagors in the United States, they asked me to write a manual, which I did. I finished this in late 08. That the timing wasn't really great because they were preoccupied with all kinds of other issues. So but they actually published this last June or July. So you can actually get on the web this if you go to the Mortgage Bankers Association, and it describes how to think about optimum refinancing, and there are other things like paying points and things like if you have cash, should you pay down your mortgage? Some very practical considerations applied to mortgages. Nothing to do with mortgage backs. This is basically not for the individual users, but more for the brokers or for the banks to advise mortgagors. A bit too technical for mortgagors. Just as an aside, about a year ago, when I saw saw the defaults coming up, I went back to the mortgage. I had already completed this manual, but I said, went back to the Mortgage Bankers Association, and I said, I'd be happy to write a chapter on optimum default, which is a really interesting question. I don't know how much you read about it. In the U.S., there's no recourse, and you can do it, and there's a lot in the literature. And they said, no thanks, we don't want to talk about it. So I didn't do it. But now, of course, if you open up in the U.S., the newspapers, default is all over the place, whether it's ethical or not ethical, and all this stuff. So it's not there. But anyway, this came out, and we also asked for a patent, and we got a patent 2 weeks or 2 or 3 weeks ago for the calculator that you can see on our website, so you can see how it works. And essentially, it's like a swaption calculator, so I just want to mention it. So why am I telling you this? The point is that you can apply bond valuation technology rigorously to mortgages to determine the optimum time to refinance, and I hope you believe me that that can be done. And when you apply it to mortgages, like you can see on this exhibit, What's the optimum? Well, it depends on the refinancing cost. And you see, if the cost is 1% of the outstanding principal, you should refinance when you save about 40, 45 basis points. If your transaction cost is 2 points, you should save about 70 basis points. So, sensible numbers. And again, it's pretty straightforward analysis. We have a calculator on our website that you can try out if you like. Now, once you have this notion of optimum refinancing, you can build, at least this is how we approach it, you can build a prepayment model, not by assuming that people refinance optimally, because they don't, but by having a fixed point, and you know what's optimal. So once you know what's optimal, you can talk about suboptimal in a sensible way. If you don't know what's optimal, all you have is a house of cards, all right? So the idea is that, before I get into refis, first of all, there are some assumptions about turnover. This is just people who leave the system because they move or die or something has happened, divorce, move, I guess, and they have to sell. And there are some assumptions on that, and that I'm not going to talk about. Everybody can use the same assumption. The interesting part is the refinancing. How do you do that? So if you know what you're doing, you should refinance like a financial engineer. We call them FEs. Sunday I was listening, I don't know if anybody happened to hear Paul Volcker being interviewed. Anybody? You know who he was. And he kept on making these somewhat very critical comments of financial engineers, and I really felt bad about it because he said, the financial engineers created the financial, you know, this crisis and so on. I mean, I think I was the director of the first financial engineering program in the U.S., I think, at Polytechnic, which is the Poly NYU. And clearly, engineering products was the last thing that, you know, creating prices was the last thing we wanted to do. The whole focus was on risk management and getting engineers to learn finance who then could apply their knowledge. And anyway, that's a whole other story. So if you know what you're doing, you should refinance when you reach 100% efficiency. But most mortgagors are not financial engineers. So the idea is then to model people who are not financial engineers. It turns out people don't refinance too early. That cannot happen because I can explain to you why. I want to save some time here. But they wait too long, so we call them laggards. And there are various degrees of laggardness, and mortgagors refinance. The more laggard they are, the more they wait. So this formulation automatically takes care of what's called the burnout problem, if you know what the burnout is. And then, so we have these buckets, and then we assign weights to the buckets. And if you go at the look at the paper that I wrote, published in 2004, here is the kind of simple assumption that we use for buckets. Let me explain. So 50% of the mortgagors are financial engineers. They do it right. Then about 25% here weight 50 basis points. They are 50 basis points laggards. What that means is that, let me give you an example. What does it mean? If you have a 6.5% mortgage, what does it mean to be a 50 basis points laggard? You will refinance your 6.5% mortgage when a financial engineer with a 6% mortgage will refinance. Okay, that's the idea. If you're 100 basis points laggard, you refinance to 7% mortgage when a FE who knows when to do it refinances 6%. It's a very easy thing, very convenient way of describing behavior. And we have stuck to this very simple assumption in terms of a negative exponential distribution. And I will show you, I'm not going to show you sensitivities to the distribution just to save time, but we have not changed the distribution. We changed the spacing every now and then, but that's about the extent of it. And it seems to work well. So this is the distribution of laggard distribution. The system we call is CLEAN, and it's an acronym. And I will now describe what's going on here. So we have two things happening. you have mortgage rates that drive refinancings. And you have a security, mortgage-backed security rates, which are used for discounting the cash flows that come from mortgages. These are two separate things. And we represent them, again, it's somewhat simplistic, but it seems to work fine, as a coupled lattice. So we have two option-adjusted spread, one for mortgagors that reflect the mortgagor's credit, and one for mortgage-backed securities, which is more like agency bond credit. That's kind of the general point. When we do risk management for mortgage backs, the option-adjusted spread, again, is an output of the price, and then we work with that, as I mentioned at the beginning. So I'm going to show you some examples. Again, the mortgage rates determine refinancings, and the MBS cash flows that come out are discounted on the MBS lattice. And we assume they are perfectly correlated. So they look like this. You have an MBS lattice here, and the mortgage lattice here. Okay. Now, let me pull out some quote, and this is a little bit old, but I came across it recently, and I like it because it certainly reflects my sense of what's happening in mortgage-backed securities and prepayments. And quote, prepayment models have stayed away from economics and have increasingly relied on the fitting of data, this complicated ad hoc parameterization. And I hope that those of you who are familiar with prepayment modeling will agree with this. I have been watching this, by the way, since 1981 when I joined Salomon Brothers, and the people who were doing the mortgage back, were the fellow who ran the mortgage back analytics for MBS, was next door to me. So we spent a lot of time talking about this, and I can tell you what was happening then and how we got to where we are, because Salomon was the first one, as you know, that introduced mortgage backs, I believe, in 1979. And again, just quoting from the JP Morgan report, they say, well, you should be able to model behavior by economic incentives. And that's what we try to do. Talk about economic incentives instead of complex parameterization. And I will give you an example. How can you increase refinancing speed in this very simple model that I have just described? So here are some ways. If you improve the mortgagor's credit, because they can refinance earlier, easier, more easily, all right? That's one way to do it. You can reduce transaction costs. If there was no transaction cost, everybody would refinance immediately, as soon as you can save a penny. Reduce transaction costs, you get more refis. Assume that people refinance more efficiently, reduce their laggard spacing, make everybody look more like a financial engineer. These are different ways of achieving basically faster refis. Now, so I'm going to close with an example. And here is a study we did last week for a so-called TBA, a new 4.5% mortgage-backed security. The price was 101 2/32, actual mortgage-backed. I guess it was on the 2nd of February. The swap rates, which is the benchmark, we always need the market, so we use the swap rates, US dollar swap rates, the 10-year was 3.75, the 30-year was 4.44. Remember, we have two option-adjusted spreads, one for the mortgagor. We assume this was 96 basis points to the swap curve. I like to refer to it as roughly as a single-A corporate credit, somewhere in that neighborhood. Turnover rate is like 6% a year. That's close to what people use. We use the standard Laggard distribution that I showed you. Transaction cost 1% of principal. And this is all the inputs. That's all you need. Speaking of transparency, these are the only parameters we're using in this analysis. And when you put in the 101.2 that price 101 2/32. The system says, okay, you solve for the MBS OAS, and it says it's 8 basis points to the swap curve, which is like an agency bond, 10-year agency somewhere, close to it. So this is an output, and when it's 8 basis points, and we freeze it, and I'm going to show you now what happens when we do risk analysis on this actual bond, actual MBS, all right? So first, I'm going to shift the yield curve. We cannot go too low because the short end of the curve is already so low, we can only go down. This is zero, not no shift, because, you know, the short end would be negative. So we go down only 20 basis points here, keep in mind. So it's not symmetrical. But I'm just showing you here what the two lines. This is our line. This is the Bloomberg. Just Bloomberg is in the public domain, but you could use other systems that you have access to. And you'll find that the response to shifting interest rates, shifting the market rate, is going to be very similar. The durations are going to be very close, should be fairly close. And this is what you get, which is good. But now, my focus is not on shifting yield curve, which is one dimension of the market risk, but shifting volatility. And I'm going to show you what happens now. So here's what happens. We start at 30% vol, as you saw, and then we go down to 20% vol and up to 40% vol, and we see what happens to the price. The initial price was 101 2/32. So clearly, if volatility goes down, the price goes up. If volatility goes up, the price declines. But notice how the traditional model, the Bloomberg model in this case, exaggerates the sensitivity of the price to changes in volatility. And I'm going to explain to you why I think it's exaggerated. And this kind of segues into that comment I made earlier where people are unhappy about the response of the models to when they try to hedge portfolios. So you can certainly see that an option adjusted, an option-based payment model dampens the effect of volatility because the decision to refinance looks at some sense, in some sense, it looks at the option value. But what do other models do? So I'll try to give you my somewhat simplistic interpretation of what happens. But remember this exhibit because this is critical. So let me explain why what the problem is with traditional prepayment models and why they have trouble coping with volatility. So the first observation is the current mortgage rate drives refinancing speed. Clearly, the rates are lower, you get more refis. That's pretty obvious, right? So we agree on that. You can think of, conceptually, of the current mortgage rate at any time, but then current mortgage rate, as consisting of two things. One is a benchmark curve. So people say, let's look at some linear combination of the 2-year and the 10-year and the 30-year rate or something. That's one input into estimating the current rate. But then there's a spread on top of it. And that spread is supposed to capture not only the mortgage or credit or whatever, but it is also supposed to reflect the refinancing option, the cost of the refinancing option in the mortgage. If rates are volatile, the investors presumably will demand a higher spread than if rates are assumed to be very steady. Right? But here's the problem. So the higher the volatility, the wider should be the spread that you add on the benchmark rate. But traditional TPM is traditional prepayment model. The way they used to do it, the mortgage rate that they specify, they depend on the benchmark curve, but not on the volatility. So when you go through and simulate the future interest rates, the benchmark curves go wider, higher volatility implies rates go lower, they go higher. That's true. But the spread that determines, that estimates, attempts to estimate the then current mortgage rate, that spread is not volatility dependent normally. At least it didn't used to be. You follow what I'm saying? And so what happens then, if you increase the volatility, the traditional model underestimates the effect of higher volatility on the mortgage rates. So these near the money mortgages, like the 6% bonds that I showed you before, they refinance too soon instead of waiting like I showed you. So what happens is the duration shortens in these cases, but in fact, when you think it through, you realize the duration should be longer because volatility is not captured in the estimated mortgage rates. So this is kind of a simplistic description of my understanding of how these models work. And what went wrong? Well, first of all, the whole thing started out on the wrong foot, in my opinion, because it was all about cyclical behavior of mortgages and how much they prepay and so on. And the whole refi was an afterthought, going back to 1980-81. And then, starting with this foundation, I mean, the only way I can describe what has been going on is patching, because there's no theory underlying yet. It's patching, and more patching. They call it, everybody comes out, all these, and a lot of very smart people work in this area, they keep on coming out with these enhancements, and they never end, because they can never explain what's going on, because the foundations are not solid. So, in fact, this volatility, now they are trying to incorporate volatility into this model, into this S-shaped curve, if you know what I'm talking about, but it's an afterthought. It's outside the model. It's not inside the model. And so they can never work right, in my opinion, because it's a very artificial way of doing things. The parameters are not based on economic incentives. So you don't know, there are too many parameters. You don't know there are unexpected results. I don't even want to get into that, because those of you who work with these models, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And there remains a fundamental inconsistency between mortgage backs and bonds versus bonds and interest rate derivatives, because of this very artificial way in which options are being exercised. So that's my story. I have a couple of other exhibits just to tell you about. I like the option-based approach, obviously. You have few parameters. You understand exactly what you're turning. You can refine it if you like, but you get realistic. We have always, I claim, we have had very good responses to risk management scenarios. Calibration is intuitive. You understand exactly. I hope you followed all the parameters that I stated, whether it's transaction cost or OES or whatever. And it's really fast. Now, one of the big problems with mortgage backs is that it typically is very slow. I mean, if you go to the standard system, you're lucky to be 100 valuations per minute. I hope you know that. We do 15,000 easily on a low MPC because it's recursive, because we deal with bonds. Each mortgage, each MBS is like 10 bonds. So if we can do 200,000 callable bonds per minute on a PC, so we can do 15,000 mortgages. So it's really fast. And it's not Monte Carlo, it's recursive, so you get higher accuracy. I'm not going to get into whole loans and private labels. You can handle them like in any other model. And just to conclude, if you're in MBS, understand what you're working with. Look across, look not only at the MBS model, but see what's out there in terms of interest rate derivatives and bonds. Understand how the refis work and understand the limitations and demand an answer. Whoever is providing you your prepayment model, to say, how is it working? Is the refi option-based? Why is it not what's the excuse for not making it option-based? Make sure it's consistent with your MBS valuation is consistent with the rest of fixed income. So demand transparency. I mean, these are just standard statements, but I hope you agree with me. So that's my talk. Thanks very much, and I'll try to answer questions if there are any. Yeah, please.
Variable mortgage. it's always the lowest rate. And it is like one which would be perpetually refinanced because your rate follows the market. So you have no refinancing to worry about. And the rates go up or go down. So in a way, into the customer takes on the risk and the spread and benefits from the spread.
Who's the customer? The mortgagor? The homeowner?
The homeowner.
Personally,
I'm not at all risk averse, so I always prefer variable.
Okay.
And
all right.
And I think that you, at the end of the day, always come ahead. So you take some risk, but so on. So it seems to me that that is a very simple example to what you're saying. Which is what I mean.
In what?
Because when you have your fixed longer-term mortgage, you pay more. And the higher the rate volatility, the more if you want, you pay for your peace of mind. So you don't want to have the volatility of the rate.
Right.
Okay, give me that volatility. Get me, you know, a lower, the lower spread.
Okay, let me first of all make a comment that may shock you. So in the U.S. you have the 30-year fixed mortgages standard. You also have what's called hybrid ARMs, which have hybrid ARMs. So the rate is fixed for the first 10 years, then becomes a floater.
Okay.
There are some that are fixed for the first 7 years, for the first 5 years. Then they start floating. So if you think about these, you see on a 30-year, you get a lot more option to refinance. So by any measure, the 30-year fixed should have a higher rate than these hybrid ARMs. But it doesn't. Can you believe it? Did you know that? This is a real shocker.
Well, people probably don't think so long ahead. They
No, but why? I'll give you the answer. I mean, it's not a... It has to do with securitization, because the 30 goes into the... it has to do with demand for the 30-year. It's amazing. I'm amazed to see people going for these hybrid ARMs when they could get it at lower cost. A 30-year mortgage would give them all the flexibility. Another issue in terms of, I'm not sure it's going to answer your question, when you get into these refinancings, and we also try to understand when, not only when fixed rate mortgages refinance, but also when variable rate or adjustable rates refinance. And it's a very difficult question because, in terms of modeling, we haven't been able to get our arms around it. Because the question is, why did you get, many times people have an adjustable rate mortgage and then they refinance into a fixed rate mortgage. The question is, how could you get an adjustable rate mortgage in the first place? And what changed between now and then? Because as you indicated, you stick to your adjustable rate mortgage, right? But many people kind of get cold feet. And they say, I've done it for 5 years, but now I'm worried, and I do it. So I don't know how to respond to that. I'm not sure anybody else understands that.
No, it's not about mortgage. It's just like an example to make your...
To
make your presentation.
About this volatility? Increased. But I didn't quite understand. So how do you know that with an adjustable rate you always have the lowest number? Because you have transaction cost if you want to refinance, don't you?
You never refinance. You just go like that.
But what if it goes higher? What do you do then? How do you know it's...
You're stuck with it.
Yeah, all right.
You say, you know, that's my model.
But you haven't...
Okay.
All right. I don't claim to understand really what goes on with adjustable rate mortgages and how they work.
Okay.
Yeah, please go ahead. Yeah. Oh, the way you can, that's a great question. Look, one way you can do it, Freddie and Fannie, and so Freddie Mac, they post MBS, I'm sorry, mortgage rates. You can back into it. You can see what's the implied OAS. That's one way to do it, from the market rate. The whole point in calibration is that you can look at actual prices and actual quotes and work backwards to get these OASs. Yeah, the price at par, that's exactly it. The price at par. I'm not an expert, but we're looking at IOs and POs, and the whole thing is really, really strange because, you know, the OESs for the IOs are so high compared to the OESs for the POs and for the... It's very, very hard to understand, so I would not... Partly. I think if you use a prepayment model like this, you would dampen the results. We have just done it and we get... But still, the POs are very rich relative to the IOs, no matter what you do. Anything else? Or? Yeah, please. It's completely... if you go back to the paper that we wrote... this one in 04, we have this distribution, and the point is, how sensitive are your results to this distribution? And just to save time, I omitted to show you that the results, particularly when you do risk management, tend to be very insensitive to that particular exponential, as long as it's exponential and you sort of spread it out. And I should have told you there's some infinite laggers on the far right. But you should try it again and you'll see it for yourself. When you get into burnt out pools, and when you get, if you know about the factories, if you get into factors which are 0.05, which means only 5% of the original principal is outstanding, then of course these models become hypersensitive to this assumption. But I'm talking now about new pools, and that's where most of the action is. Well, you know, you're making an interesting point. Well, Dan, I don't know if this is going to answer your question, but what's fascinating about mortgages is that there is no optionless, at least in the U.S., you don't have something that you would describe as the optionless mortgage yield curve. Because mortgages are always called, you have 30-year rate and 15-year rate mortgages, but they have a refi option built into them. And that's it, you have 2 points. And so the question comes up, what should be the credit? Because if you had kind of something that you could defer to as an optionless mortgage or yield curve, you wouldn't need this OES. You know, for corporates, you have a corporate credit. Every company has its own specific yield curve based on its credit.
I actually like the idea of the lagger funding. That gives you some information. The difference from those rates gives you some information maybe of how efficient the market should be. I mean, the prepayment option or say a cancelability option on a swap, you don't go and readjust the rate because you actually go, you assume when it's going to be canceled,
yeah,
and you value the option. You don't say, well, because my option didn't actually match the prices, I do it. So you have to think to have some other...
Well, it is admittedly very simplistic, but let me just make one comment. Suppose that everybody happened to be a financial engineer, Now you know everything works optimally, so you don't need a distribution. So how much higher would mortgage rates be? Have you ever thought about it? What if everybody refinanced optimally? I can give you the answer. It's about 10 to 15 basis points. That's the difference that it makes. So on a new pool, it doesn't make a huge amount of difference what you do in terms of, you know, this distribution is not... Well, because then you get very discontinuous payoffs. So, for example, if you do scenario analysis, suddenly everybody refinances at the same time. That's, you know, then it becomes like a bond. So what we try to do is represent this as 10 bonds or 12 bonds. That's why, because you want to get a nice continuous distribution. But in terms of valuation, I don't think it would make much difference. You get more realistic cash flow patterns. Okay, I think we have... Okay, thank you.